Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Working to become debt-free can require a lot of changes for a family, perhaps including trading in the title of homeowner for renter. Yeah, sometimes a few minor changes are needed in certain situations, but sometimes it might call for an entire financial reboot. We'll learn more on how to do this and whether or not starting over can actually work. Then, the idea of saving is good, yet we aren't always successful at it. What if there was a program where half of all your future pay raises were automatically put away into long-term savings? The idea is called Save More Tomorrow, and it could make a big difference. And it's big employers and big institutions instituted. It could really change the conversation here in Canada. We'll talk to a consultant about how it could work. And mutual funds are under pressure as investors increasingly look towards lower cost options like robo-advisors and exchange-traded funds. These industry changes could mean some portfolio managers and advisors will get pushed out. We'll talk more about the future of the wealth management industry as it relates to technology. Plus, financial jargon can leave even adults guessing when it comes to their personal finances, but it's never too late to learn more about money. ABC Life Literacy Canada has a new program called Money Matters that works to provide straightforward financial literacy programming for adults. We'll talk to one of the folks at ABC to learn more. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Sometimes all you need to get a handle on your money is a little nip here and a tuck there, a tweak, a trim. And sometimes a much more dramatic intervention is called for, perhaps a complete financial reboot. That was the essence of a question that landed in my inbox recently. So we're going to take a look at that question. Joining me to provide some guidance on this specific question with broader learnings about reboots in general is Preet Banerjee. He is a personal finance expert, speaker, and author of Stop Overthinking Your Money. Hello there, Preet.
Hello, Bruce.
Stop Overthinking Your Money. We're not going to overthink our money with our reader, Susan, in Whitby, Ontario. Now, I feel a bit conflicted about this phrase financial reboot because on the one hand, it connotes big change. Like it's like a big, big change.
Right.
But on the other hand, it also implies speed because when I reboot my computer, it's really simple. I just turn it off,
Right. Turn
it on again, and everything's magical. When you think about that phrase, is it a good phrase? Should we use this phrase?
I understand the appeal, financial reboot, doing a control alt delete on your finances.
Yeah.
The problem with that analogy is with a computer, you're getting rid of like short term data for a short term fix. Personal finance is about the long term. It's about the trade-offs you've made over a long period of time and how they affect you for a long period of time. You can't just sweep that under the rug, right? You've got some financial baggage that's going to stay with you. So a financial reboot can make sense for people, but I think is wrought with danger.
Right. Okay. So we're going to answer the question even if we don't use that phrase. Susan in Whitby says, we're considering selling our house and renting a house in the same neighborhood. That's important. So we're not downsizing, but rather doing a financial reboot, her phrase. This would let us become debt-free, replace our two aging vehicles, pay for kids' university. We have enough RRSP room to allow us to essentially pay no income tax for 2 years. The cost of renting a house is equal to the cash outlay of owning a home. The only financial pitfall I see, says Susan, is not having the real estate increase over the period of time that we use to reboot, which is about 5 years. Let's talk about the pros.
Sure.
First of all, what are the pros of this plan?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. One of the big pros that I think a lot of people are thinking about is because house prices have gone so high so quickly over the last couple of years, last 20 years, really, people are wondering, should I cash out? Should I time the market
and
sell out of real estate and do something else with that money? So this can look attractive because the ratio of prices, house prices to rents, is out of whack in a lot of neighborhoods.
Yeah.
You know, and the reason for that is as interest rates have fallen, for the same level of income, you can carry a lot more debt.
Yeah.
So that drives house prices in many cases. Rents are more tied to labor, and you pay your rent out of your income. So if your income isn't skyrocketing, like your ability to borrow more money because of low interest rates, that kind of puts a ceiling on how high rents can go. So that ratio of prices of houses versus rents is kind of out of whack for a lot of these neighborhoods. And she's just outside of Toronto. So this may be a neighborhood where it can sort of make sense on paper.
Yeah.
to execute a strategy like this. And I say makes sense on paper because the thing about personal finance is we think some of these strategies are the fix-it solution for all our problems, and we don't realize how tough it is to stick to these plans.
Yeah, and on that notion of selling, I could see selling and monetizing the equity gain in the house. My question is concern is buying or renting a house in the same neighborhood.
Right.
Because it seems like a great opportunity to downsize. Mm-hmm. If this is a family, and they're a family with a lot of financial needs, and there's been some, you know, not great behavior in the past, this could be a course correct if you're willing to alter lifestyle, which I don't think she's willing to do.
Right. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. If you're going to do something like this, then I think maybe should be even a little bit more drastic. Because the overarching theme that I see with this plan is that they are freeing up equity, converting that into assets, which will then be used to spend on other things.
Yeah.
So they want to replace their car. So you're now converting cash into depreciating assets. So that's not ideal. They are now able to afford to pay for their children's education. So that's an expense that maybe they wouldn't have paid for had they not executed this plan. So there's a lot of things to consider about, you know, what is the overall goal? I also noticed that she wants to be mortgage free by the time that they retire. So she's 52 now, and their plan is to potentially re-enter the housing market in 5 years. You'd then be 57.
Yeah.
If you get a 25-year amortization, you're not retiring until you're 82.
Yeah.
Right?
And there are jobs you can do till 82, but they're not that many jobs you
may
can do.
May not be that high paying either.
Yeah, yeah. The other question that I have is on discipline. So
yeah.
If they've got themselves into this challenge and they use their house to pay off all that consumer debt, have they corrected the behavior that got them into the crummy circumstances in the first place? And there's nothing about this plan that would indicate that they have.
Right. Yeah. And again, I think this is key, is the discipline. So a lot of people will say, listen, if I look at the cost of home ownership compared to renting a comparable property, that difference in monthly cash flow, I can just put that into the market. I can invest it and I will grow that faster than the growth rate of housing going forward. So yes, that's where it makes sense on paper. In reality, it's a lot easier to skip a voluntary contribution into an investment portfolio than it is to miss a mortgage payment. So for a lot of people, one of the reasons that Canadian housing has been a primary driver of wealth is because people don't miss mortgage payments until it's like the last straw to go. But when it comes to saving on their own volition, it's very easy to say, well, you know what? Let's stop the saving for a little bit and go on a vacation. We've got all this free cash flow now. We can start the savings, you know, 6 months down the road.
Yeah.
And take this opportunity to travel the world. And that is a very difficult thing to do.
In a subsequent email, I asked Susan about retirement savings, and she said, and retirement tithing, and she said, we won't be retiring soon due to poor financial decisions in the past. So how do you roll retirement savings into this? It kind of goes back to my downsizing thing. Like, get out of that great asset, but don't just clear the debt, replace the cars, but also have a lump sum towards retirement, which currently isn't there.
Yeah, which is also a very interesting consideration of its own, because if you presumably have made a lot of financial mistakes up until the time you're 52, you probably don't have a lot in the way of an investment portfolio yet. If you now have a lump sum and you're investing for the first time with $100,000 plus, that is a very risky thing to do, to start investing with a large lump sum. A lot of people, the benefit of contributing on a regular basis starting young is that you don't feel the volatility when you've only got a few thousand dollars in your account. When you've got $100,000, a 10% swing is a change of $10,000. And that can freak you out to the point that you actually change your portfolio strategy. And when we talk about the historical returns of what's available in the stock market and balanced portfolios, there are so many people who don't even get half of those returns because they keep changing their plans.
Right. So let's talk about what a better plan could include. So we've got the circumstances of the debt, the, you know, paying for kids' education. I mean, firstly, I'd probably take that off the table, that
yeah.
The kids are going to have to make their own way on that front. But what would this look like that isn't the financial reboot that Susan suggested?
You know, I think she should give strong consideration to actually staying in the home and not selling it. And here's why I say that. If their plan is to eventually buy again, the cost of selling, you've got your realtor fees, you're going to be paying, I don't know, 30, 40 grand to sell.
Right.
5 years later, you're going to be spending maybe another 20 to 30 grand to buy because you've got land transfer taxes and so on and so forth. So those costs, those transactional costs,
the 10 grand to hire a mover and repaint the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, all that stuff. You don't get those transactional costs back. So all these years where, you know, she's saying, you know, this outstrips the cost of home ownership, that is maybe not the right sort of projection to be looking at. If you don't factor in the transactional costs, that can take a big, have a big impact on your retirement savings. So staying in the house and maybe making more drastic changes to just their lifestyle expenses might actually be a more solid plan. I think what Susan really needs to do is get a financial planner to run all the different options and to really see, well, what are the transactional costs to execute each of these strategies? What are the probabilities that housing keeps going up? Or if she's waiting for a correction, what is the probability of that? And factor in all these different scenarios to see which option, which strategy might actually look better for them.
And you're talking like a, you're talking about like a fee-only financial planner?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, if you can pay for someone by the hour, so that's a new type of compensation model that is gaining more popularity. People like that because there's less conflict of interest. You're just paying them for advice. They don't have a vested interest to say, well, of course you should sell and use that money to invest.
It's also a bit of a different skill set because it's not about buying an investment product. It's about modeling.
Right, yeah.
Which not every financial advisor has.
Right, exactly. So the fee-for-service transaction model is where you pay by the hour. Fee-only actually has a number of different connotations. It actually just means that you are paying by fees. Those fees could be a percentage, which is kind of the same thing. There's still an alignment to promoting having more investments as opposed to a house in this situation. But a fee-for-service advisor you would pay by the hour, and that's certainly one viable option.
She's got kids 17 and 21. They may need to get a bigger job, a better job, more hours at the Starbucks that they're working at on the weekend.
Yeah, I think the reality is, you know, it would be nice to pay for their education, but maybe just paying a fraction of it on an ongoing basis might be the strategy that they look at down the road. And the kids are going to have to know, and the sooner you tell them, the better, that you're going to have to be responsible for a lot of these costs yourself.
It's a tough call. Thank you for your insight, Preet. Appreciate it as always.
Always a pleasure, Bruce.
Preet Banerjee, personal finance expert, the author of Stop Overthinking Your Money.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Saving? Good. Our success at it? Bad. So what if there was a hack to how we behave that could increase the amount we save? What if someone had offered you a program back when you were in your 20s where half of all your future pay raises were automatically put away into long-term savings? The Save More Tomorrow program out of the University of Chicago does just that. Joining us to talk about this program and what might actually be possible here in Canada is Amelia Young. She's a principal with Upside Consulting Group, and she focuses on the financial services industry. Hello there.
Hi there.
What is Save More Tomorrow? How does it work?
So Save More Tomorrow is a program that was designed by two academics in Chicago, Richard Thaler, who recently won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work.
Kind of a big deal. He's kind of a big deal.
Yep. and his colleague, a guy named Shlomo Ben-Artzi. Hopefully I'm not butchering his name. And so they were doing this work in the late 90s. And they actually started with a problem. The problem they set out to solve was that people who had access to company pension plans were not signing up for them.
Right.
They were leaving free money on the table. So that was what they set out to study. And they applied the learnings from behavioral economics, which says that human beings suffer from mental traps that stop us from doing things that we know we really should do and that we, in fact, want to do. So they took their understanding of these mental traps, and I can tell you more about those if you want in a sec, and they designed this program called Save More Tomorrow, which offered employees an opportunity to sign up for their pension plan, but to defer the contributions until they got their next raise. So effectively what happened was they sat down with employees who were not contributing to the pension plan, asked them why, and they said, well, I can't afford to. And so they said, well, how about you expect to get a raise of about 3.25%, 3.5% next year. How about when you get that raise, we will increase your contribution rate by 3%. So basically you'll lose most of your raise. And it was fascinating because 78% of the people that they offered this deal to took it. And then 4 years later, or 40 months and four pay raises later, 80% of those folks were still in the program.
Wow.
So they went from saving nothing to saving over 13% a year of their earnings.
So we talk a lot about behavioral economics on this show, but let's put a fine point on it as it relates to this particular program. What are some of the traps, looking at it through that lens, and how to save more tomorrow, combat those traps?
So I think there are three in particular. You know, the behavioral economics literature has dozens of these things that they call cognitive biases. But there are three that come into play when it comes to saving in particular. The first is myopia. We're just, as human beings, one of our fundamental flaws is that we focus too much on the short term, what's right in front of us, what we want to do today, what pressures are breathing down our neck today. And, you know, what's going to happen years from now, or even, you know, hours from now, tends to fall off our radar. We struggle to keep that longer term perspective. I like to call that one the hangover bias, because really anybody who's had one hangover in their life, there's actually no reason why anybody should ever have a second, because you know exactly what's going to happen.
Beer, that martini, that G&T,
exactly.
It's right there in front of me.
Exactly. And so we just forget. So myopia is one of them. Another one is choice overload. So, you know, if anybody who's gone through the process of trying to enroll, even for their company pension plan, which is a substantially simpler exercise than normal retirement savings, there are just too many choices at once. How much should I put in? Where do I find the money from? Which of the gazillion funds that they're putting in front of me? Too many choices.
Right.
And so we just shut down and do nothing. We put our heads in the sand, go la la la, moo la la la.
Moo la 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 la, yes, yes.
And avoid it. You know, the sky's not going to fall if I don't deal with this today, but tomorrow never comes.
Right.
So choice overload is the second one. And the third one is just inertia. This takes action, effort for us to do, and we don't do it. There's, I saw a talk recently where the phenomenon of Netflix having its post-play feature, where when you're binge-watching and you finish an episode and before the credits even roll, it starts the countdown to the next.
And you accidentally watched five episodes of The Crown.
Yeah,
you don't even know how that happened.
Apparently removing the need to make that one click to watch the next episode, That is an example of taking advantage of inertia.
Now, this thinking has been around for a very long time now. Why have Canadian financial institutions not made it their practice to adopt this thinking? Financial institutions and also major employers who spend buckets of money on pension plans.
So this work actually has had a big impact on pension plan design in the States. So
why not here?
I don't know if it has here. It's a smaller market. There isn't as much available information. But basically, over a 15-year period, U.S. pension plans went from basically none of them offering an auto enrollment and auto escalation feature. That's really what Save More Tomorrow was. Over half of U.S. pension plans have both an auto enrollment and an auto escalation feature because of this research. So that may well be, maybe it'll be the case in Canada as well.
In your piece in The Globe, you were talking about financial institutions, and there seems to be some inertia on their part to follow through on this. Why do you think that is?
So there are a couple of things. It's much easier for employers to implement these kinds of plans as it relates to their pension schemes because they have easy and cheap communication channels into their employees. You know, that's not the case for a financial institution.
Right.
The other thing is they know when the raises are coming, and they can time different communications to coincide with what they're paying you. They can time it to take advantage of bonuses, all that good stuff. Banks only see it when it hits your account.
Right.
So it's tougher. But with, you know, this is the beauty of the fintech revolution that we're witnessing right now, that digital tools and algorithms that can analyze data provide a ton of opportunities to take advantage of this kind of thing. So we're early. We've only had the technology for not that long of a period of time. So they're making progress. I think the bigger part of the problem, frankly, is that this is a longer payoff opportunity for the banks. I get really excited about consulting in this space because I think it's a win-win that we can help consumers and we can help the banks improve their bottom line. But, you know, in this world of managing to quarterly profits, you know, getting people to put away an extra 2 or 3% of their earnings this year and next year and the year after that, it starts to get meaningful after 2 or 3 years, not this quarter.
One last question. If you don't have an institution, either an employer or a financial institution, driving your behavior, what could you do yourself to save more tomorrow, adopting these principles, but there's obviously going to be a bit of a human touch, and it's yours?
So we're lucky to be living in this time where there is this plethora of new fintech tools out there. So there's the coolest one that I've seen yet is from a Montreal-based startup called Mylo, M-Y-L-O. And they offer a service where you put in your debit cards and credit cards, and they will do a roundup on every purchase that you make across all of your accounts. And what's interesting is there have been services like that around for a while in the States, but these guys automatically roll it into a robo-advisor for you. So your money actually is being put to work for you. So that's a big one. The first thing is to know where your money goes. So RBC is ahead of all of the other banks in terms of its tools that show you where your money goes with virtually no effort.
Right.
They have a tool called Manage My Finances that with a couple of clicks, you can see where your money's going this month, this
right.
quarter, 6 months. So look for those kinds of tools. BMO has one as well.
Yep. TD has MySpend.
Yes, that's true. It's only in the app, though.
Right.
So if you don't, you know, it's kind of difficult for those of us over 39 who struggle to see things on tiny screens. But find one of those tools. And RBC's in particular is good because it allows you to aggregate accounts that you have at other institutions.
Right, right.
You might not be comfortable putting your information into Mylo's website. You know, it's a startup, security questions. But,
yep.
you know, RBC's, we can probably trust that.
Right. And if it's all at one.
So you can get that holistic view of
right.
where all your money's going.
Interesting. Amelia, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. Amelia Young, principal with Upside Consulting Group, on this idea of save more tomorrow. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, how to measure the performance of your investment portfolio. We'll talk about a new online quick check that allows you to compare your returns against similar portfolios. And later, artificial intelligence has been making milestones across a lot of industries, but finance may be the final frontier. I don't know. We'll talk more about the future of the wealth management industry as it relates to technology. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Stay with us for the rest.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Selry on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Selry. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Sports teams only get the trophy if they win relative to their competition. So when you're assessing the performance of your favorite sports team, you look to the other teams for context. The same goes for the performance of your investment portfolio. Relative performance is one way to judge your success. Now, there's a new online tool from Asset Risk Consultants called Quick Check that allows you to compare your returns against similar portfolios managed by high net worth advisory firms. ARC's director, Andrew O'Neill, joins us now from London, England, to talk about it. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
How does Quick Check actually work?
Well, Quick Check draws on the peer group indices that we've put together since 2006, available across 5 reference currencies, based on our private client indices.
And what do I need to do to input my information such that I can see that apples are compared to apples?
Right. Well, you visit our research portal, suggestus.com. And there you need four inputs, no login or registration required. We've tried to keep the level of input to a minimum. All you need to do is type in your reference currency, the approximate level of equity exposure you have in your account, the performance you have over a time period in cumulative terms, and what the time period is. And the minimum is a year, and at the moment the maximum is 5 years.
And what's the report look like? What is it going to spit out that makes me feel good or bad about the person who I'm paying to manage my money?
Righto. Well, once it's got that information, the machine can then take it away and compare your outcome with the outcome from portfolios of a similar risk profile. And we then grade it into three categories on a traffic light system. So you'll get a red, green, or an amber indicator. Green being a happy outcome, amber being a middle-of-the-road outcome, and red being a sad outcome. And we've used emoticons to convey that.
Nice. Okay. And what percentage of portfolios, like how does that work? Is it a normal curve that you're forcing onto the distribution of data, or how do you determine what's red and what's green?
We're broadly doing it a third, a third, a third.
A third, a third, a third. Okay. And how many portfolios? So a consumer gets this report, and then they see they've got their red or green or whatever. What are they supposed to do next?
Well, the portfolio base across the globe, and we've got five reference currencies, is about 150,000 accounts. The actual contributor base depends on which reference currency you're taking. So in Canada, I think there's about 7,000 accounts in there from 20 contributors. So that'll give you a representative idea of how you're doing, your level of risk against the competition.
And how do you get your data?
The data for the quick check comes from individuals' account statements. Our underlying data is provided to us by portfolio contributors and composite contributors within the marketplace.
And why would they provide you that data?
It's to provide a peer group index to the investment community. We didn't have these when we started this in 2006. We didn't have peer groups, and now we have.
So who would use that? Aside from the consumer, it's relatively new that the retail investor could look at it and gauge performance of their advisor. Who else uses it, and how do they use it?
Well, the managers themselves can use it. We see applications in their marketing documents. We're not publishing league tables here. What we're doing, though, is giving managers a chance to, if they want to, publish their outcomes against the industry averages as an adjunct to what their target, what an investor's target rate of return might be, or what the benchmark outcome may be to complete the performance appraisal picture.
I just want to come back to this question of what do people do. So they get a red light with a very sad emoticon, probably. Do you expect that then they will call their advisor and say, hey, I got this thing, could you please talk me through it? Or do they fire them immediately without passing go? Do they just burst into tears and call their therapist? Do they self-medicate? What do they do? All of the above? Or just call you at home on your mobile and like yell at you?
Well, they can do that if they like. The initiative is designed to be a rough and ready measure. So it'll give you an idea of where you are in the grand scheme of things. Ultimately, then, it's designed to promote dialogue where we think dialogue may be necessary. So if you're substandard, then you might want to go and investigate the reasons why.
Now, there is a huge move here in Canada around education for retail investors on fees, and that's not the only variable, but that's one variable. The higher the fees you charge, the harder it is for you to outperform. How do you link in the market indices as well? Because that's another way to look at it. Did they do at least as well as the TSX or the S&P 500 on their equity position?
The initiative is designed to work at the outcome level, and it recognizes that particular investors will be positioned along the risk spectrum. They're not going to be 100% in cash. They're not going to be 100% in equities within their accounts. They'll lie somewhere in between. So by looking at, by assessing which risk bucket they're in, and we split the market into four, you compare yourself against portfolios with a similar risk profile, net of fees, to get some idea of where you are. So it's designed to supplement benchmarks and not replace them.
How have advisors received this tool? I can imagine for some of them, the winners are like, woo, I'm amazing. You're welcome, world. And the mediocre are thinking, geez, could we please not tell anybody? I'm going to, you know, build my practice based on my charm, personality, and good hair.
Well, I think the reality of it is that no one stays in the bottom quartile forever, and no one stays in the top quartile forever. So it's designed to be a fair measure of where you are and a realistic one.
But do advisors like it or hate it?
Oh, they've responded to it very, very positively. It lets them helps them design their storyboards, see where they are relative to the competition, and just generally get a more informed picture of where they are.
How often should people be doing the quick check look, and how are fees incorporated into that? Because that's one of the knocks on comparing apples to apples, is that the fees aren't necessarily wrapped in. How do you think about that?
Well, the returns that we receive from managers that this initiative is based upon are all net of fees. They're struck net of fees, so that adjusts for that.
One last question here. Disclosure rules. Investment firms have to provide rates of return. They have to, you know, compartmentalize the advice out. How does QuickCheck account for that context?
Well, QuickCheck is designed to, I think we designed it with CRM2 in mind,
yeah,
where once a year, to go back to your earlier question, you're given a number, and this gives you a means of, over that time period, and there's another debate there about whether it's representative or not, but it's a starting point, let you see how you've done within that time period.
Interesting. Appreciate your context here, Andrew. Thanks for making the time for us.
Thank you.
Andrew O'Neill was on the line from London, England. He's with Asset Risk Consultants, and he was talking about QuickCheck, a tool that allows you to compare your returns against similar portfolios managed by high net worth advisory firms. Coming up later on the program, the Moolala Questionnaire. But next, technology may soon replace more jobs in the wealth management industry, but it's not just because of AI that there's this transformation underway. We'll talk more about what technology can and cannot do. Speaking of technology, how about a low-tech option here? Books, physical books. I've written a couple of them. You can order them online, in a bookstore, wherever. The first is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Hello, I'm Bruce Ellery. You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple. If you believe the futurists, artificial intelligence is going to replace us all. Hosts of personal finance radio shows will be at the top of the list. I'm sure I'm out, replaced by a robot. But so too may many jobs be in the wealth management industry, not just because of AI, but for lots of different reasons. There's so much change happening. Melissa Shin is the editorial director of Advisors Edge, an investment executive, publications focused on the investment business. Hello there, Melissa.
Hi, Bruce.
So you did a piece on this. Your publication did a piece on this broad topic. What did you find? Where did you focus?
Well, we've done a few pieces. So there's been a lot of consternation, shall we say, amongst advisors, as you mentioned on the top, that their jobs may be ripe for disruption for sure, and definitely are concerned about that. So certainly, we've looked at portfolio management side of things, the wealth management and portfolio management side of things. We've also looked at the potential for advisors to be replaced by robo-advisors, which is sort of the hot term. They don't really like that term. It's usually online advice that's preferred. But of course, robo-advisors, as us in the media know, it's a little more interesting to use the term.
Yeah. There have been some layoffs of portfolio managers at some big brand name companies like BlackRock and BMO. How big a trend is this? What sense do you have was that just headline grabbing, or is this a systemic shift?
Yeah, I mean, it's a systemic shift in the sense that costs pressure is becoming more important for clients. They're understanding that, as education grows through, a lot of personal finance, that fees are important. But also, advisors are also very important in the sense that they help people along when they're trying to make decisions. But in terms of the portfolio management aspect, yeah, I think a lot of portfolio managers are seeing their compensation on average go downward because of ETFs primarily, which are a lot of them are passive investments that essentially, don't require as many people looking into the investment aspect of it. It's set up with algorithms a lot of the time, and then you also have sort of the hybrid, what's been called smart beta or active ETFs, where you have algorithms that are sort of managed by people. But as you can imagine, it doesn't require the same number of people potentially. It's still a lot of skill. It's just sort of allocated differently.
Do you have any numbers on the comp decline? So a portfolio manager was making on average X, and now they're making on average Y. I can expect that a big hit has been on the bonus side of things.
Sure. So we've actually seen, CFA Society, Chartered Financial Analysts, they do a national survey. In 2011, they found that average compensation was $397,000. It went up to $629,000 in 2014, but that was an average that was, pushed up by a lot of big bonuses. Bonuses tend to be decreasing now. What they're saying now is, like, a good average fund manager could earn between $200,000 and $400,000 a year before ETF boom, and now it's sort of declining a little bit from there. Bonuses are also, it's sort of hard to justify large bonuses when, maybe funds aren't performing as well. It's really, as you can kind of see, the larger conversations on compensation in terms of CEOs and things like that, there's a lot of stay on pay activism and all that kind of thing. So kind of a trickle effect into the other areas.
Would it be safer to be a portfolio manager in a niche part of the industry? Say your focus is on healthcare stocks or small cap stocks. Are there differences there? Are you harder hit if you're more of a generalist?
I think it's, if you can differentiate yourself as in any business, that's really important. There's a lot of sort of big names out there that are well known for earning a lot because they've sort of managed to beat the market consistently and that kind of thing. And that can be hard to replicate, as you can. So if you are specialized and looking at something that others aren't, I know on your show you've recently had people talk about, gender diversity ETFs and things like that. You can kind of make a name for yourself that way if you're looking at something different. It's just sort of, specialization versus generalization.
Let's isolate the tech variable for a second here. This notion of artificial intelligence, which is a phrase that seems to encompass everything. What are some of the trends that you're watching as it relates to AI? So if we park the fee pressure and CRM2 and consumer awareness about fees and all that stuff to the side, just looking it through the lens of technology, what are the big trends, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think sort of the understanding that it's not just about wanting automation. I mean, there's a lot of times where people can kind of go into, a web interface and click a few buttons and they get an answer. And I was actually at an event yesterday for insurance brokers where they were saying, people, they are only actually asked three pieces of information before they get a quote. And they'll call the call center and say, wait a minute, is that enough information? Do you have enough? Is that okay? And so it's very interesting that, I guess we as humans are used to interaction and we're used to, sort of maybe bouncing ideas off people and that kind of thing. So sometimes when it's too cold or it just seems too easy, maybe people get a little bit suspicious. And I think what we're seeing, especially in the realm of financial advice, is that the real strength comes from hybridization. So where you have the technological tools at your disposal, maybe to create a portfolio solution for you or to automate things like rebalancing, and then the advisor can really focus on getting to know the client better. There's a lot of times when, if there's a checkbox that you just fill out or a questionnaire that you just fill out about risk, for instance, and ask you, how do you feel if the market was to go up by this much or to go down by this much, how would you feel? And that's not a conversation. That's just sort of looking at something and putting an answer in. Whereas a person, an advisor, can kind of sit with you and say, okay, when the market crashed you know, in 2008, how did you feel? What did you do at that point? Or what kind of job are you in? Are you in a job that's really risky? Are you a freelancer? Do you kind of rely on many sources of income, or do you just kind of have, you know, one job that's very steady, or do you have a pension? You know, those kind of things
are
not necessarily going to be captured that way.
What are some of the challenges that you face in covering this industry? And I ask because the industry that you cover is also your advertiser. It is your subscriber, whatever the business model is. And it must be very difficult to be critical of it because many of your readers would have confirmation bias. They want to read your publication for confirmation that what they're doing is working, not that, you know, this world is transforming and they need to step up and really consider doing things differently, or maybe that the gravy train is going to stop. How do you navigate that?
Right. Well, do that helps with that is we see ourselves as educators, not just journalists. You know, first of all, we do see ourselves as journalists, and we do maintain a healthy distance from the industry. You know, we write editorials that sometimes we get letters and they say, you know, you're anti-advisor, and sometimes we get letters of support. So really, it's, you know, we are reporting the facts. Certainly, we are trying to educate our readers, you know, to the point about confirmation bias. You know, I think what we try to do is actually write stories about what is coming so that they can be prepared. And if that doesn't really jibe with their worldview, the whole idea is that they can, you know, get ready for that if it's not yet. You know, we want to show them how to be better advisors so that they have those tools to say, you know, as I'm sure you've reported on quite a bit, there's, you know, a backlash against high fees, and it's really about them showing that they are actually valuable. And if they can't do that, then they, you know, maybe they don't belong in the industry. So it's really important, I think, for us as journalists to educate and make sure that people see the content in our publications that allow them to become better at what they do.
Interesting. Melissa, thanks for your time today.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Melissa Shin is the editorial director of Advisors Edge and Investment Executive. Lots of change going on in wealth management. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, financial jargon can be complicated even for the average adult to understand. But we'll learn more about a new program from ABC Life Literacy that's working to change that. We'll also take you through the Moolala questionnaire. Sign up for the Moolala newsletter at Moolala. How do I screw up pronouncing Moolala? I've been saying it for years. Moolala.ca. Subscribe to the podcast version of the show on iTunes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You've probably heard me say on this show that it's never too early to start saving, but I'd also say it's never too late. A new program from ABC Life Literacy Canada and TD Bank called Money Matters works to provide accessible, easy to understand financial literacy programs for adults. Joining us now is ABC's Executive Director, Mac Rogers. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
Tell us about Money Matters. What was the goal and how does it work?
Sure. It's we designed it for low literacy learners. So this is a program that is really for learners that for whatever reason have become disengaged with education. So we run a program that really focuses on bringing the fundamentals of financial literacy into the classroom. So this could be the banking basics, it can be budgeting, it can be learning about credit. And so we have a few different programs that we run, but they're all of them have the same goal, which is to increase the confidence, reduce anxiety, and really just get people starting to think about and act on financial management.
When you said low literacy, do you mean people for whom reading is a challenge?
Yes. So low literacy, so there's, according to an OECD study, over 40% of Canadians read below a high school level. So what we really wanted to do was make sure that it was accessible. So it's written what we call in the literacy sector a level 2 level. So that is reading roughly at a grade 6 to 8 level, and so it's very easy to understand, but it is still based for adults, and it allows them to internalize it and get what they need out of it.
How do your adult learners find you?
So we don't actually run the programs. We use our amazing community network. So if you're in Toronto or Winnipeg or Nova Scotia, you would go to your learning center and they would then run the program. So it's it really is a very effective way to get as much programming as we can out there without us having to touch each and every learner.
Right. And it may be that your program is offered alongside a bunch of other literacy and life skills types of programs that are outside of the financial area.
Exactly. So for some programming, it's built right into their numeracy or their math, introductory math program. It could be built into their life skills program. It could be built into their literacy and basic skills program. It's really where the instructors think it's the best fit.
What would be an example of some of the things that adult learners would learn in this program?
Sure. So as you can imagine, adult learners come with a whole variety of life experiences and lived experiences. So what we really try to do is make it so it's learner-directed. So the core programming is delivered where we actually bring in TD Bank volunteers to deliver the program so that learners get a chance to ask the big questions. They can talk about anything they want, although we do have workbooks that guide them through the kind of four main pillars of financial literacy. But it's all about that interaction and letting them choose what is most relatable and the information they need right away. So it can be conversations about how to build a budget, but it can also be conversations about what's the right cell phone plan or what's the right bank account or how do I build my credit score. It can really go anywhere they want it to go because it is intentionally conversation based.
And is it a 1 hour session, a 1 day session, an hour every week for the rest of their life? What's the sort of story? I mean, hey, I'd sign up for that. We could all use it regularly.
Yes, absolutely. It is. There's a few different programs that we run. So the core one, the main one that we run, is 8 hours of programming over 4 workshops. And then our First Nations, our Money Matters for Indigenous Peoples, that's the same kind of program, but designed with the stories and the vignettes are more from an Indigenous culture perspective. And then we do have one for program for newcomers, which is based more on, it's more seminar style, and that's two-hour sessions. So it can really vary.
What's the training process for the TD folks? Because in some ways, it's material they know well. Let's say you're a branch-level employee, you know this kind of stuff, but you're talking about populations in which there can be a great degree of cultural nuance. Maybe there's English as a second language, maybe there's issues of poverty. How do you ensure that they're prepared to walk in the room and keep their biases in check?
That's a great question. So all TD Bank volunteers, the first thing they do is they go through our online training. So we've designed custom online training that, as you say, it does touch upon the subject matter of financial literacy and gives them, the basics of what the program is. But really the bulk of the training is on adult learning theory and on learning how to manage a classroom and being aware of those things, like you said, choosing the right words and being aware of other people's lived experience and what it's like to live in poverty in Canada, because so many of our learners are living below the poverty line. So what we really want to do is make sure that training talks about how to deliver it that's much more important than the actual subject, because the subject takes care of itself. Like you said, they're the subject matter experts, the workbooks are straightforward, and we want the learners to take it where they want it to go.
What can you tell us about the impact of these programs? I mean, I can imagine qualitatively people who have completed them would have extraordinary testimonials. Is there a way to think about, improving their ability to, climb up the financial ladder, get a handle on their debt? What are some of the metrics or results that you would talk about?
So that's a great question, and it's a question that the whole sector, the financial literacy sector, has been trying to nail down over the last few years. So what we do, because we're a short-term introductory intervention, is we assess, the main things we assess is their confidence and their anxiety, and we've seen really remarkable results in that confidence is going up 40 and 50% for most of the programs, and even higher for our some of our specialist programs like the Money Matters for Indigenous People. And we see anxiety decrease, and then we also ask them about questions of intent to change behavior. So do you intend to open an RESP for your kid? Do you intend to start budgeting? And again, we see significant results. So we use external evaluators to try to create an authentic story as possible. But of course, recognizing it is a short-term intervention, and it's not. So once someone goes through a program, if they're looking for more information, we often refer to them to other sister organizations that may have deeper and longer programming that can really dig in and things like financial coaching and debt management and those types of things as well.
What do you find about how the conversations unfold in the room? And I ask because for so many people, regardless of income level or life circumstances, they find it exceedingly difficult to talk about personal finance for lots of different reasons. How does that work? Do people here self-select and show up and they're like, sleeves rolled up, let's go? Or do the trainers really need to create that safe space and kind of bring people along slowly?
It's a little of both, to be honest. So the first thing is we do the programming in their safe spaces. So we're actually in their classroom.
Right.
They own the classroom. They own the space. The teachers are there that they trust and rely on. We train our volunteers to be very aware that trust is a big issue, and we talk about confidentiality and, you know, the cone of silence within the classroom. And to be honest with you, we're very surprised at the transparency that our learners come with. Mm. They are very open to talking about their financial literacy, their challenges, and of course, there's going to be the odd occasion where there's anger and upset in a classroom because of, you know, often it's a misunderstanding of how the banking system works or how credit score works and that sort of thing. And watching our great volunteers kind of navigate through this and learn and respond and feedback, yet still always validate the lived experience is really remarkable. So you end up with even with people who are coming in who may be a bit upset by something.
Right.
They're coming out with some nice resolutions, which I think is really important in getting them back towards the right direction.
That's great. Thank you very much, Mac. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Rogers is the executive director of ABC Life Literacy Canada, and he was here to talk about the program sponsored by TD Bank called Money Matters. Time now for the Moolah La Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money and a little bit about life. Amelia Young is our guest today. She is a principal with Upside Consulting Group and focuses on the financial services industry. You ready, Amelia? The first thing that comes to your mind. It's like a game show almost, except for there's no prize.
But I have no button to push.
You have no button. There's no prize. Number one, how would you describe your money personality?
Schizophrenic.
Schizophrenic. Okay. What does that mean?
My husband will attest that sometimes I can be incredibly cheap, but, you know, it's like I have a cheap muscle that gets fatigued. And then after I've been cheap for too long, I sort of lose it and then go spend too much money on something that I really shouldn't.
Oh, and what would be your category? What's your guiltiest spending pleasure category? When the willpower is exhausted, you go for?
I go big. I go renovations.
Okay, we need to introduce you to shoes, handbags, and cheap sell-off vacations instead. Really, renovations?
Yep.
Do you renovate because of an aesthetic need or a functional need?
It actually has a tiny bit of a financial literacy component to it, because I convince myself that these renovations that I'm doing to my house or my cottage or whatever are actually building equity, and I'll get the money back.
Because you're increasing the value of the home.
Exactly. So really I'm not spending money, I'm investing.
No. Now, should I tell you that the last part of how that works, right? You only get the value if you sell, right? Is that new
news? I'm on my fourth or fifth house and second cottage. So
okay. So you're kind of a flipper.
Yeah.
What has been your best financial move of your entire life, aside from like the investing in my education or I don't know, the cliche ones? Something specific. Do you have a grow op in any of your properties? Is that like one of the? Oh, did that hit a little too close to home?
I lived around the corner from one once.
Really?
That was interesting. Yeah,
wow.
A nice little sleepy suburb in Markham.
Could you tell, or it was only afterwards that people were like?
It was only after it got raided that people found out.
Right,
yeah.
And they noticed some mold in the basement.
Yeah. No, I think my the single biggest thing that's contributed to my personal wealth so far was buying a pretty run-down, dated house in a great neighborhood, and over a period of 9 long, excruciating years, mostly a lot of sweat equity for my husband.
Same husband or different
same,
husband than today?
Yes,
that's an important
husband,
question.
Yes,
same husband.
Yes,
okay,
yes,
all
yes.
Right, good.
So we doubled our money on that house.
Worst financial mistake at the other end of the spectrum?
It's probably a bunch of little things. So in the interview we just did, I would have said the key thing is starting with small good behaviors.
Yeah.
Small bad behaviors add up. And so I'm still a ways from retirement, so I just willfully ignore the negative consequences right. of my small bad behaviors.
Right.
You know, it's the eating out, it's the nice bottles of wine sort of on weeknights. Yes, there's some travel and clothes in there too. So it's those things, they really do add up.
When do you think you will retire and what will you do?
What I love about what I do now is that it is the kind of thing that can just be scaled back and continue to do forever. I mean, I love what I do. It keeps me energetic and learning. So I don't think I'll ever completely retire. But, you know, I'll probably scale back to half time when I'm into my 60s kind of thing. Mm.
If you were to have a financial windfall, and I'm calling $25 million a financial windfall, what would you do? What would you do with it?
Oh, it wouldn't take that much.
You're like, a windfall? That'd be like $500.
I would go do a doctorate.
In?
Actually, probably behavioral economics.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I've often thought of it or take a sabbatical and write a book, but all on a similar topic. I really am passionate about this stuff.
Oh, that's great. You could just buy the doctor online. I think if you Google buy doctorate for free, it doesn't even have to cost $40,000.
Well, that doesn't satisfy the learning desire.
Oh, yeah, that part. Mm, right. What if you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large like this, what would it be? I know. I'm giving you the powers of an otherworldly spirit figure.
So I, off the top of my head, I think I'd say credit card debt.
Uh-huh.
Like there should be something that prevents you from running a balance. You know, I think credit cards are a wonderful thing for having visibility into where your money's going. Those people who say, you know, spend cash in a jar, I think that makes no sense because you don't know where it's going. The traceability is important. But, you know, just that is a hole that people dig themselves into and just can't seem to get out of. And I guess, you know, one worse than that would be the, you know, the money lending kind of
payday loans,
outfits.
Installment loans, all that stuff.
Yeah, things that trap people in a cycle of poverty, I think, are quite tragic.
If you were to look back on the arc of your life, who would you say has had the biggest influence, positive influence, as it relates to how you behave about money in the present?
My grandma.
Ah, what's her name? Did you call her grandma or granny? What'd you call her?
Called her grandma.
Nana, Nona, granny.
No, grandma.
Okay.
Yeah, good old-fashioned grandma. Her name was Anna Nemeth, and my older daughter's has her name, her middle name. She taught me to wash out bread bags. Like, why? I think I was 30 before I bought a Ziploc bag.
Right.
Because I was like, we are throwing this stuff into landfill instead of reusing it. She taught me to be incredibly frugal, which, you know, helped serve me extremely well when I was just starting out. She'd be horrified at how I waste money today.
Right.
So I'm embarrassed to say that. But the lessons are in there somewhere.
And if you could take one of those and implant it in the psyche of your daughter, your family, whomever, mm-hmm. would it be washing out bread bags?
I think it would be.
Which I do. I don't do bread bags, but I do Ziploc bags. Absolutely.
Okay. And so now we buy Ziploc bags, but we absolutely do wash them out.
Good.
More from an environmental perspective than anything else. But I think, you know, my grandma, what made her so special was she economized but didn't make it feel like a hardship. She made it feel like just good sense.
Right.
And we spent a lot of great time together doing things, not just washing out bread bags.
Right.
But,
hey,
you know,
Grandma,
like,
let's hang out and wash bread bags.
Being industrious, you know, sewing clothes, always cooking at home. She made those things fun.
That's
and
great.
So I think looking at frugality as a choice and something empowering and developing some neat skills.
Yeah.
I think that's a great piece of advice.
Layer of consciousness about it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Amelia. Amelia Young with Upside Consulting on the Moolala Questionnaire. That is our program for today. You can drop us a line at ask@moolala.ca. You can find me on Twitter at Bruce Sellery, S-E-L-L-E-R-Y, Bruce Sellery, Moolala on Facebook. Now, to listen to past episodes, you have a couple of choices. You can go to iTunes and download the episode. You can also go to our website, moolala.ca. And if you click on the podcast link, you can listen to the entire episode, or you can listen to just the segment that you're interested in. Over on iTunes, you can listen to the full podcast and even write us a review. How nice would that be? Maybe even subscribe so the next episode just shows up on your device automatically. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a great day.